Thank you for the nice introduction. I'm honored to be the journalist in residence here for the next 2.5 months. And it's a great pleasure to me to talk to you today. So I'm based in Munich, Germany. What is, as you probably know, is on another continent. But coming here to KITP feels more like coming to another world to me. And that's why I choose The Little Prince as a guideline to go through what I want to tell you. Who knows the book? Who has read it? Most of you know it. I make it a very short introduction to the book for those who haven't read it. The author is Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. He was a French author and pilot, born in 1900, and he died in 1944 at the end of the Second World War when his plane was shot down over the Mediterranean. Saint-Exupéry had worked as a pilot in Argentina and Africa, and the book is about a pilot as well who has to bring down his plane in the desert. And he's very busy fixing it. He's in a hurry because he hasn't got any water. And out of nowhere, there comes a little boy who asks a lot of questions and never stops before he gets an answer. And so I think this is quite an analogy to the world of journalism that is also far, far away. And like the little prince planet is very far away where he's coming from. And it's a very strange planet as well. And what Lars mentioned already, please feel free to ask questions. I will also try to ask you some questions, and maybe we get into something like a dialogue. The dialogue will not stop today. I think this is just a start, and hopefully we'll have a lot of nice conversations and maybe some workshops on one issue or the other. So the little prince comes from this strange planet where he has got 3 volcanoes that have to be cleaned every day. And the question is, why does he go away? I mean, I like my place also in Munich, but we both went away because we're very curious about other things that are happening. And we both ask a lot of questions. I've been dreaming about becoming a science journalist since I was a student. I had read a book from a German professor called Heinz Haber, who was writing about the evolution of the universe, and I thought that was fascinating stuff. That's what I would like to do. At that time, science journalism was a profession. not very popular. Not many people did that. So I started writing for a newspaper while I was still a student, and after I had made my master in geology, I went into the publication business. I worked as an editor first and later became a freelance science writer. I was reporting for a series of popular science magazines in Germany, like Bild der Wissenschaft, PM, also for radio, Bayerischer Rundfunk and TV. And I also do popular science, customer science magazine for a German research organization. It's actually the biggest European research organization on applied technology, Fraunhofer, based in Munich. And in 1991-92, I was taking part at the Knight Science Journalism Fellowship at MIT. Okay, so that was a short introduction to my history and my role. And maybe what I also should tell you is that I'm not a physicist. I told you already I'm a geologist, but I'm not specialized on geology either. I have a very broad field, and I covered a lot of science and technology in my life, from the Big Bang to the history of pasta. And so name it, I've got it, but I never went too deep. But during my talk, you will see why that is. Okay, so When I was thinking about how to tell you physicists about science journalism, I thought, yeah, maybe I have to go a little bit into words you understand. And I was thinking about science journalism and figured out there are different forces that make this world spin around, and they are actually, I named them strong and weak forces. The strong forces being the things that drive the editors and the audience. The editors always think they represent the audience. And the strong, the weak forces being how journalists think, what they have in mind if they talk to you. After I have introduced you to these weak and strong forces, I want to talk a little bit about the history of science journalism, reflecting, I'm making a shake here, reflecting what people or what a broader audience feels towards science. And in the end, I want to figure out what all that stuff could be, could mean for you, or how you could use it. So let's come to the first strong force. That's the news. News is something everybody likes, everybody's interested. Imagine in the old age, people were asking the neighbors or the travelers that came around what the news was. Today you might open up a newspaper, or you look it up in the internet, or you listen to the news on the radio. So news is a driving factor in journalism, always has been. And journalists are always looking, digging for something that might be new and interesting to their audience. Like the little prince who looks for a great view up there, the journalist is looking for great news. So the question is, what could be news in science, right? I mean, we're talking about science communication here. So I brought an example for you. You all know that. So the news was the Higgs boson was found. The question I want to ask you, why on that day? What do you think? I guess there were scientists working for a longer time. I mean, that's normal. Why? What was it?
It was done because of the conference in Australia, I guess it was.
Yeah, right. CERN made a press conference, right? Mm-hmm. If it was a press conference.
They wanted to announce it so that the experimentalists could speak at that conference.
Right.
About it.
Okay, so it was sort of planned, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So that news was planned, that the CERN made a press conference, they published it, they told it to the journalists, and then it was the news. So you see, PR can work very heavily on that issue. I brought you another example. This is a little, I'm still not very familiar with the American system of making copies, so this is sort of glued together. But we had that last week, right? So this was Satellite Uncovers Bonanza of Black Holes. That was a press conference NASA gave, obviously. So the PR business is very strongly engaged in making news. Everybody wants to break news because that brings them to the front page. I mean, is this just something that's obvious, but it is good to just have it in mind. So news is something that has to happen today. So if I plan a press conference or some outcome of some way, I have to do it that day, the next day. It might be covered, but then it's history. Then a feature might come up or a background story, but the news factor is gone. So that was a new finding. What else could be news?
Well, let me ask a slightly different question. So, you know, some journalists don't like the sense of being manipulated by the press releases from a university or from a scientist. Because that's, of course, what we're intending to do, is to get the journalists to write the story based on the press release. So maybe you're going to get to that, how you as a journalist view the press releases, which is the scientists or their institution trying to generate news by doing a press release rather than another mode, which would be the journalist actually thinks it's of interest and decides to write a story.
Well,
then it never presses.
Yeah, the journalist would, of course, like to have it earlier, yeah? So this is always a question of policy, how an organization deals with that. I mean, if they have decided they want to put it on the news or do the press conference on that day, they will probably not give it to you a day earlier. But you're right, I mean, this is a very broad field. How do you interaction between PR and journalism? I always have the impression that it's a little bit different in Europe than in the US. That was my personal feeling. That what you just mentioned, American journalists are extremely careful with taking information that is sent to them from some PR person. My impression is that in Europe, this is happening, yeah, they are less concerned. That does not mean that they just use the press release. Yeah, they do their own story, but they might just use the information. So the concerns are obviously a little bit. Does that answer your question?
Can we understand what you're asking? You're asking what is news?
Yeah, what else could be news?
What else could be news? I think that two different kinds of news that could come out. One is short collaboration, few authors. There you have the freedom. You can contact the authors, you can, you know, because normally we publish first on the electronic archive, which is completely open. You could, many journalists actually go and visit some of these archives regularly, they contact the authors. But I think the big collaboration papers, just such as the Higgs boson, is really released after lots of internal reviews, it becomes news, it becomes newsworthy more than anything else, after it has gone through a lot of process. So they can't give it to you because they themselves, even though it's being discussed maybe for even a year, they are not sure that what the outcome is, what the final statement is,
yeah.
Because it has to be agreed by probably 2,000, 4,000 people.
Yeah, right.
So that's a very difficult process.
It's a process, yes.
So the question is, what is newsworthy? What exactly is the statement we will make?
Yeah.
And you can see there were a lot of caveats that was put when the Higgs boson was announced.
Right. Now, I was just asking what else. I mean, what came in my mind, some new findings, some scandal, scientists lied and said something wrong or something like that. That would also be news.
I suppose so. Journalists should definitely expose bogus science and science that is manipulated just for the purpose of news should also be exposed.
That could also be the case. Maybe some money has been given somewhere, some big grant, somebody has won a big grant or so, that would also be news. I'm just pointing out things that could happen to you and you might think I could use it. This is just the idea. Also some local events, like somebody holding a speech at a university that might be interesting for the local newspaper, just to invent them. Sometimes this starts an avalanche, like bigger newspapers picking it up. So I think if you are interested in this sort of business, just think about how the news, is there any news factor in it? Yeah, so that would be, okay. So. The second strong force I want to talk about is the story. While the news was something that's really happening on one day, the story can happen any day. So what could be a good story? So I just ask you, I don't ask you now as scientists, but as readers or consumers of media. Why would you like to read a story? Sarah?
Everything in a story that has captures your imagination, just as the obvious story is curiosity, that had all the elements of a narrative. It had suspense, it had drama, it had excitement, visuals, it had potential for good and bad outcomes, and human beings involved at every level. So that's obviously a story that would hit the news.
So a person and feelings and emotions and something cinema in my head.
Something at stake.
Something going on, yeah, imagination. Any other ideas? What would you be interested in when you open a magazine? Why would you read a story about science or technology, not in your field, but in general?
I think it's general, enhancement of overall knowledge that not necessarily in our own field, maybe it is in biology.
Knowledge, like you learn something more, you have...
Yeah, you know more about the universe.
Okay, yes.
Maybe the implications?
The implications?
The implication
why I would need that, yeah.
In particular, answering the question that people really care about or are fascinated by, for example.
Yeah, right. Any more suggestions? Let me check what I found. Yeah, emotions. I also found the emotions, the big questions. Something I haven't known before. Something thrilling, maybe, and unexpected. Okay, so that would be about what a good question, what a good story would be. I think good stories were always something people liked. In the old age, they were sitting around the fireside, and today journalists are the experts for telling stories. But the interesting question is, how do they get these stories? I mean, sometimes you read really good science journalism and you think, how did they get it? They just didn't walk into this institute here and see the people sitting there and have their stories. So it must have come somewhere. So the instrument to get the story is ask questions, like the little prince, ask a lot of questions. Yeah? And eventually you will step over something that's really interesting, unexpected, whatever the scientist might have done something when he was a little boy that brought him to that invention or whatever. So it's just a process that takes a lot of time, and just sit together and talk, and sometimes helps. So be prepared when you enter this world of the media, you might be asked a lot of questions, even personal questions. Americans are more used to these personal questions, I think, because the newspapers start the stories always the way that there's somebody, a person involved. Europeans are a little bit more stiff in that way. They don't like to answer personal questions, or how they drove, or what the phone said.
So I have a question in this regard. You mentioned that you have a broad range of interests. Now, to recognize whether something is interesting, one needs some background knowledge, is my prejudice. So as a journalist that covers many fields, and probably don't have in-depth knowledge of all those fields, how do you decide what is interesting for you?
The journalist has in the back of his head, he has his editor. So at the moment I hear something, I scan in my head whether that might be interesting for one of the editors I'm working with. And if I have the impression, okay, that could be a story, then I start thinking about it and asking more questions, whether that's really new or not, or exciting in a scientific way.
Is it really the editor that you care about, or the audience, actual audience?
Well, actually, the editor pays my bills.
I know, I agree.
So it's basically the editor I have to think about, but the editor thinks that he's speaking for the public.
Interesting, yeah.
The question is always, is that right? But personally, I don't care too much about that, but... So, of course, I think about the audience, but the audience doesn't pay the bills. But I will come back to that later. So, but your question is, regarding whether I could say this is something really thrilling or interesting, I can say it might be for the audience of that magazine. But I have to ask you for the science, right? Is that science really interesting? You have to answer that question before I start. Or you would have to answer the question. Does that give you an answer? Not really.
But you can't talk to many people, so there is some kind of a selection filtering process on your part, right? You must be reading something and say, oh, okay, this sounds interesting.
Yeah.
And then you contact the authors, or do you contact the editor?
Right, you contact a scientist, or the author of the paper, or... I will come back to that later, how it usually works. We we're asked digging for the story, right? So the third strong force is the impact. So one thing one of you mentioned already was, is it interesting for my life? Does it have any impact on my personal circumstances? So it turned out that within the last years, more and more stories were about the impact. In the earlier days, I will come back to the history of science writing in a minute. In the earlier days, there was more writing about some science is interesting in general. Today, a lot of magazines really want the impact, what has to do with history. But that means that it's easier right now, for example, medical articles like new drugs or so that are good for everybody because a lot of people know somebody who's got Alzheimer's or whatever. So the impact stories turn out to be very often about medicine and biotechnology. So it has become a little bit harder for other sciences. For applied science and research is also a little bit easier. And I brought you an example that is from Fraunhofer, what is sort of this, everybody can use it, impact examples that had a lot of coverage. That answers your question.
The largest human organ. It is a sensory organ that protects our bodies and is integral to our metabolism and immune system. For the past few years, this important tissue has been grown successfully in the laboratory using tissue engineering methods, but only in a costly, labor-intensive manufacturing process at specialized laboratories by trained personnel. Until now. In 2008, biologists and engineers from four Fraunhofer institutes joined forces to create a project that is truly unique in the world, a factory for human skin. Initially, we wanted to show that we can produce test systems where human tissue can be used as an alternative to animal experiments. Because many studies have revealed that drugs tested in a clinical trial may cause side effects in patients that did not appear in the animal experiments. The skin factory consists of three fully automated modules. In the first module, the equipment separates skin cells from a piece of human skin the size of a postage stamp. A laser beam measures this biopsy. Then the sample is minced by a small blade, allowing the individual skin cells to be extracted. But who would actually need artificial skin models like these? The initial target group for whom we developed this device includes companies that are involved in cosmetic, chemical, and pharmaceutical development, and that rely on the use of tissue for both risk assessment and impact analysis. At the beginning of module 2, the isolated skin cells are filtered out so that they can proliferate. This process of cell division can be easily detected under the microscope. The cells are dividing here at the top in the highlighted region. In order to stimulate propagation, the cell cultures are placed in an incubator for about 2 days. A robotic arm regularly retrieves them so that cell growth can be examined and tracked. Depending on the growth, each dish receives its own special diet through a pipette. Despite all the technology, it's not the equipment that sets the pace, it's the biology. So the system must be able to respond flexibly. Almost like a fourth module, the software running on this system controls the whole process and acts as the interface for the user. This is by no means a rigid process. Instead, we have processes that hinge on cell growth. In module 3, the cultured skin cells are placed on a gel matrix. The skin tissue is able to grow here. Mixed well with collagen, within about 2 weeks, each of the small plates holds a full-grown, three-layer piece of skin, just like human skin, with the epidermis, dermis, and subcutis. At the end, each of the 24 virtually transparent pieces of skin in the dishes has undergone a fully automatic quality control process. Even when it was just a prototype, the system met all the hygienic standards of good manufacturing practices. The short-term goal is to develop cartilage and skin with blood vessels. In other words, skin that can also be used directly as transplants for patients. The major advantage is that we intend to produce autologous transplants from the patient's own cells. We start by taking a small biopsy from the patient, isolate and expand the cell type of interest, and build a patient-specific transplant. Ultimately, this means the patient can give up long-term medication therapy. The risk of rejection is eliminated, and the lack of donor organs is no longer an issue. In the future, such skin and tissue factories could be installed at major medical centers where they could grow replacement organs for patients.
Okay, so that was an example for an impact story that was, had a little science in it, and sort of entertaining. You might think basic science has not much to deliver in that way, but still journalists do write a lot about fundamental research, like if it has to do with cosmology or it has to do with the universe. It always breaks the news, and the question is why. So I found a strong force for you. And that is the search for fundamental answers. So this is a little tricky, and I think this professor here with his funny graphs shows how complicated it can be. I don't think that the little prince understood a lot when he met his scientist on this planet. But there's always the hope somehow of the audience that scientists might answer the big question of how it all started and where it will all go and what's the meaning of life. And so these stories that are involved in that get a very good circulation because people like to read it. So it's just curiosity and hope that one gets a little bit more. I brought some examples from German popular science magazines. Yeah.
Actually, returning to your previous picture, if I remember correctly, this particular gentleman in Little Prince, he could not get his science published or accepted because he was wearing a funny hat, and that was viewed as not being a serious scientist. And then finally, he changed to a more European style of dress, and then suddenly everybody was accepting his science.
So
that actually brings up the question of whether this mode of journalism, where journalism is only done, or largely done, science journalism is largely done based on press releases that are coming from, you know, let's say large collaborations or from big institutions that have already accepted and decided to support some particular piece of science, that's the only thing that sort of gets into the public domain.
No.
And, you certainly wouldn't, for example, if you were doing political reporting, right, you wouldn't want to only report on politicians who give press conferences, right, you would want to do some investigative journalism. And so the question is whether there's room for that in science reporting as well.
Oh, may I just flip back a little bit for you? Because that was an important question, I think. I left the news business long ago, see? So that was the first one. It had news. But all after that was not news. And it had nothing to do with press releases. The story style that could be a feature or reportage had nothing to do with news business, neither with press conferences and PR, right? And the impact stories are not based, they can be based on a news piece, but they don't have to. And the fundamental answers usually don't come in a press conference. I wouldn't expect them to be there.
Right? Well, is it true that this I was told by a friend of mine that write a lot of very popular books of science. Is it true that if you want to sell, make a good selling on the book, you have to put a God in the title?
It probably helps. I mean, it was a God particle. It sold quite well. No, it probably helps. I just had personally made the experience talking to German publishers that right now they don't want to print any popular science books at all. So they say they're sort of the circulation went down and the end of the boom, and they had so many, and right now it's very difficult to sell anything. So it's probably a big help to talk about God. But
even if it doesn't, if it's not the central topic, you sniff.
That's exactly the point I wanted to make. It's often a promise, yeah,
exactly.
That we give you the last, the unlösbaren Rätsel der Schöpfung, so the last miseries of creation. They're probably not solved in that magazine, right? but they promise you something. So the godlose world, the godless world of Stephen Hawking, I don't know whether he's so godless, but anyway, it made the title, it made the front page. So I think your friend is right. Put something on the front page that really sounds like you will get the last mystery solved, and unfortunately it works that way. I mean, I personally don't think that this is great. Because it's sort of scandalizing everything, and it probably comes to a halt after a while when you have a reader that has 100 times read that the last mystery that I solved.
So what are effective ways of conveying something that we're truly interested in but without having to sensationalize the discussion?
Find a way to tell a story that people, like Sarah mentioned before, their curiosity is awoken? Can you say that? That something is happening, something thrilling, something unexpected, something they want to know. Well, let's find a way. If there is one. I mean, sometimes it's really very difficult. There are probably things.
So the news journalists who are trying to cover the economy very rarely write straightforward stories about the economy because people go to sleep after the first paragraph. So they write stories about individuals, stories, human stories, that are themed and based on an experience and a philosophy they're trying to explain within the economy. So they start with the story and work backwards to capture the human element. It could be that some fundamental science has to do the same thing in some way to capture the reader first.
Right. Find some way in the story. Okay, I go ahead a little, okay? So I know from my experience as an editor, this kind of titles always sell quite well, so that's the reason the editors use them. So now we come to the weak forces. So that's what the journalist has in mind. So there are a couple of things I would like to tell you that it might be a little bit easier for you to understand. One is, I mentioned already, that the journalist always has the editor on the back of his head and his audience. So this is sort of a triangle that is interacting in a way. And the audience needs it usually, if it's a lay audience, needs it usually quite simple. So it's very important to explain what you have to explain in a way that it's easy to understand. And always have in mind that this journalist is living on a very small planet like the Little Prince that is pushing around his chair all day, and that's how he can watch the sunset all day. That's that graph. So the journalist might need it very simple, and he might not need it into too big detail. So he doesn't want to see the brightness of the star in full extension. He might need just a quote, he might need just a short explanation, so it always depends. Okay. So after having introduced it to the strong and weak forces, I would like to dig for the fundamental laws in the media galaxy. There are, in that media galaxy, there are different objects drifting around. There's the TV planet and the newspaper planet and radio planet, the social media planet, and all have their own rules. And to entertain you a little bit, I have a short piece for you how TV news and coverage is made by Charlie Brooker from the BBC. I found that very entertaining.
Before long, a standard news report visual language established itself, one that's immediately recognizable to anyone. Me has this report. It starts here with a lackluster establishing shot of a significant location. Next, a walkie-talkie preamble from the auteur, pacing steadily towards the lens, punctuating every other sentence with a hand gesture and ignoring all the pricks milling around him like he's gliding through the fucking matrix, coming to a halt and posing a question. What comes next? Often something like this, a filler shot designed to give your eyes something to look at while my voice babbles on about facts. Sometimes it'll slow down to a halt, turn monochrome, and some of those facts will appear one by one on the screen. This is followed by the obligatory shots of overweight people with their faces subtly framed out, after which the report is padded out with a selection of lazy and pointless vox pops.
Usually get some inane chatter from people.
I think they do have too much. I think what we want to hear is actually what's happening and not what other people think.
I hate these silent invites. I don't want some punters that have been using.
No. Another bit of dull visual abstraction to plug another gap now before the report segues gracefully into a bit of human interest courtesy of some dowdy man opening letters in a kitchen and explaining how he's been affected by the issue.
When I'm watching the news, I don't really, you know, there's a person talking to me, telling me what's going on, and I don't really listen to what they're saying. It's just news. It's just news.
He, unfortunately, was boring, so to wake you up, this is an animated chart, this is a silhouette representing the average family, and this is a lighthouse keeper being beheaded by a laser beam. As we near the end of the report, illustrative shots of pedestrians and signs and a pipe at a window, and then the final summary ending on a whimsical shot of something nearby, accompanied by a wry sign-off. If you're lucky, a bit of wordplay fit for a king, or in other words, a regent's treat. Charlie Brooker, Newswipe, London.
So you enjoyed it, okay? Well, unfortunately, sometimes it is that way, yeah. But no matter whether we talk about the TV planet or the radio planet or the newspaper planet, they are all based they are all based on some laws, and that is they have to make money. Either they have to get funding, or they have to sell ads, or they need a very big circulation. It all comes down to the point that without their audience and without the money, there is nothing. There are no stories, there are no news. So there is an interaction between the public that buys it and the people who give the funding or give the ads and the stories. And this interaction means that only things are selling that meet the expectations of the public. And while the expectations of the public is changing, also journalism is changing. So that happened during history. And I want to make a very short run through history now, showing how that interaction has changed. So when science journalism became a profession around the First and Second World War, science was something that people admired. They had great expectations. So the scientists were dealt like, dealt with like walking heroes that had a great message to give. Journalists were in a very devoted position. And that attitude, think about the time when you read about the space race, or the first man on the moon, or the atomic bomb, so those were really big things. And in the 60s, that still continued, but there was a different way to approach the issues coming up that was pushed by a more critical generation. I would say it was in Europe the 68 generation, and here it probably was the anti-Vietnam hippie generation. More critical science journalism came in addition, and that went on for a while. The critical journalism was very much concerned about environment and what all this science would do to humans and their environment, and the pollution discussion started there. And so these two ways to approach science went together for a while. And I think it's a little bit hard to say when that when there was a change. There was a change, definitely. I would say that just incidents, like in the US it was a Three Mile Island accident. In Europe we have the Chernobyl accident. The English had the mad cow disease. Those were incidents that people started to get very concerned. And starting to say, oh, that can't be, we don't want that kind of science anymore. So they became more critical, more concerned. And the newspapers reacted by covering these things a lot more than they had before. So the science section boomed, and the radio and TV channels brought more science stories. So there was a big interest in science. And it became a profession. A lot of people went into science journalism, and that with all these, the golden age of science journalism had started. Behind it stood the idea that the independent press had to control this science. So that was the idea. The reactions were different. I mean, in Germany, for example, research institutions and foundations put money into educating scientists that wanted to go into science journalism. So the education was changed. The idea behind that was that they wanted scientists in the business who did the reporting. I think that was a little bit different here in the US. There are still a lot of science writers out there that do not have a degree. So this was a little bit a different attitude.
Well, when you cover a science story, do you always try to get a confirmation of it? I mean, with political stories, they always try to get a confirmation, not just
confirmation, you mean different sources,
yeah.
Well, yeah, that's part of the journalistic tools, yeah, that you should ask different people about their opinion.
I don't see that all the time, but if,
no.
I think that should be built in, especially if you want to make sure that what you're reporting is authentic and...
Yeah, actually, I just read an article of that is a book about a conference about science writing where they discussed that. Point is that sometimes, very often, no, put it the other way. Very often, journalists get the idea to write something from a scientific journal, so it's probably peer reviewed, and so they just summarize it or. They call the scientist and ask you, could you maybe talk to me about that research? I mean, if it was peer-reviewed, it's sort of a little bit artificial to call another scientist who is maybe not even working in the field and say, what do you say? That's a little bit strange. So very often journalists just think, well, if it's peer-reviewed, that's good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they don't have the time to do it and they just take one side.
I'll give you an example. Not always journalist report only peer review thing. I was telling you that articles appear on some electronic archive,
yeah,
and journalists pick it up. It's not at peer review.
Okay.
And they try to report it. And in those cases, it's extremely important to have independent view of what has been reported.
Well, it could be, for example, that the journalist doesn't have the insight. He doesn't really know that this is a point of debate, that there are other scientists out there that do not know, that have another opinion, that might be.
Well, the easiest way is to go there, look at the references, list of references, pick up the names that have been cited in the references, right? And then talk to one of those who you think is the best.
Yeah, that's
good. Get an independent view.
That's
but a lot of this now, I mean, but, you know, 15 years ago, there was a science reporter at Nature who was independent of Nature because they have a firewall between their, at least they did then, between reporting and what was appearing in Nature. And he had a clear list of people he would call, and he would just call every 3 months and ask, what's up? What's happening?
Yeah.
He would find stories.
Right.
He was a real journalist.
Okay.
He was really, he would find stories.
But you mean that these stories were not going out to make press releases?
No. He would actually find what was happening in science and write stories because he was an investigative journalist. But I think most places can't afford to have someone like that on payroll.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. And but it was amazing the things he would find because he would do what you'd expect. He would call around and he had his network and there were some people he would develop relations with, and as any good reporter would. Right? But I think there's no resource for that level.
Some reporters, I mean, they call me up and they say, okay, they're asking about my work, and then they say, can you please suggest me a few names that I could talk to? Well, I might give biased names. I mean, I might give names of people whom I know will say nice things.
Of course, but the journalist knows that. The journalist knows you're going to give them that.
That won't give you the journalist another perspective. Yeah. But what Lars just mentioned, I also have a network. If I work on a story, I call those people first because I know them.
That's right.
I work with them since many years. I say, could you please just review the article I have read or give your comment? What do you think? Yeah. So this, of course, but this means that I do have a network and a connection. I know these people personally, and they like to have a coffee with me or whatever. Yeah. So because they do me a favor, yeah, it takes them half an hour from their precious time.
But they know, right, that one time in 5 years when they have a story, that they're going to be able to probably work through you, whether you like it or not, to get the story out.
Yeah, some want it, some don't. So.
I understand, but that's.
But do you have some examples of the stories that you want to say? Writing about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he found stories. He found stories that ended up scooping press releases from NASA. Because he found out the result was announced at a conference that 6 months later the person wrote the paper in Nature, but in the meanwhile he's getting the story. Well, because he went to the conference. So, sure. I mean, we don't view, you know, we don't usually hold back some result.
Yeah, we don't.
Right?
That's
so,
why
if there's a press person in the room, they'll, and if they're smart, again, scoop you. Sure. But those are rare, but that's very rare.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a big investment in time.
Yeah, and I think also in trust and to know each other, like I mentioned, a couple of friends who would call me and say, oh, I'm publishing something next week. Nice that you told me. Okay, now I can look what I can do for you. But it's just, okay, but I will talk about that a little later. I come back to it.
Too much of a little later.
Yeah, I rush through the rest. Okay, no more questions.
No
more questions. Okay.
You don't have to do everything now.
But it would be too sad if I would have to skip the last three pages. The boost in science journalism came to an end with the economic crisis, and so the science section had to be cut down again. The publishers had to save money. A lot of science journalists lost their jobs. In Europe, it worked that way. They first fired the freelancers, then they it told the staff editors they have to write more, and then they fired the editors and told them they would be better off as freelancers. And the rest, what was left, was shifted to other sections, like the science writer ending up, one science writer out of 10 ending up in the health section or in the news section. And this is important for something I mentioned before. The editor in the news section and in the health section thinks differently than the guys in the science section have thought, as long as they existed. They are interested in the impact. They just ask, what is it good for our reader? How does it help our reader? They don't think this is a good scientific achievement. They think in a different way. And so this was the boost of the impact stories, as I mentioned before. And of course, it has only been a change in the language that can be used. In the science sections, there people or the editors thought that they can use a more sophisticated language than they do in other sections. Okay, the conclusion of all science writing is in a crisis. I choose that picture of the little prince because he is next to a rattlesnake here and in great danger. But I think there's still hope. And I found hope in the book, The Little Prince, on the page where he wants to become friends with a fox. So maybe that's a good suggestion. While we are here, me as a journalist and you as a scientist, to tame each other a little bit. I mean, I think we talked about that already, and just for you to know, yeah, that would be a good idea. And now I'm almost at the end. I want to say a couple of words how I work, because by talking to you guys the last week, I figured out that some of you are a little scared. Because if somebody talks to me, it might be that the next day it is on the front page of whatever paper. I can promise this will not happen. I just tell you how I usually work, and that might make give you a relaxed feeling, and we can enjoy our cookies and our tea together and just chat. So I work usually in a way that I talk to people. And if I get an idea, I always filter these things I hear and think whether an editor or the public could be interested. And then I write or I call my editors, but I would let you know before I do that, if you were involved. And once the editor gives his go and I start writing, I would get back to you and ask you for more information so you would realize that as well. And before I send it out, I would double check my facts with you and give you your quotes, so you are on the safe side with me. But of course, mistakes can always happen, and I want to entertain you with one last cartoon. Are you able to read that, or shall I read it to you? Who cannot read this? You're done with that? Everybody done? Because there's the next page. Everybody done?
Yes.
Okay, I don't think I have to explain that. That's fine. So, things like that happen. I have the idea to ask you how you, as scientists, think you can avoid it, but maybe we need another talk on that. Or do I have 2 more minutes?
Sure.
2 more minutes? Okay. So, how do you think you could avoid that? I mean, I told you how I avoid it by double checking and double checking and double checking, and getting back to the people. But what do you think?
Choose your reporters carefully.
Choose a reporter? Okay, what else?
does it help to supply text bytes to the report or paragraphs that you formulate yourself that they can incorporate in the text to get the message accurately?
In my case, it wouldn't help. Maybe you find a report that is working that way. I think first you have to make sure the journalist understands what you're talking about. I mean, if he really understands you, that might help. So choose your words. Simple.
Really understands is a relative concept, right? I mean, he doesn't have your background, so he or she would not understand it in the sense that the scientist is understanding it. So I guess without double checking every word that's written, you as a scientist will not be able to say yes, this is okay or not, right? Unless you see the whole piece, you're not able to give it your okay.
Well, can't you do just that? And read the whole piece before it goes out. Cool. Couldn't you have an agreement
reading the whole piece is one suggestion, yeah, that depends very much. A lot of journalists I know do not do that. I know editors that say they forbid it.
Why?
Because there are legal problems. I don't know how you express that in English, I have to admit.
In the US it's the same. Some reporters will let you see the war, others won't.
What type of legal
issue? It's not a legal issue here, it's a sense of independence.
Well, it's legal and independent.
That seems to be more rare that they will actually let you see it.
But from my point of view, this is hard to understand. I mean, if you report something that I work on, without me being able to check the final thing, I mean, suppose you, despite the best efforts, misrepresent it. And then my colleagues read this piece about my work and they say, what the hell, you're not able to explain what you did to the journalist? I mean,
well, I think we first have to agree on the audience. If the audience is your colleagues, yeah, then I agree with your concerns. The question is, who is the audience you're writing for?
Yeah, but you have this image that you're objective.
Yeah.
If there were a politician who was being interviewed, would you allow them also to edit the copy? And then a lot of reporters take the same attitude toward a scientist as they would a politician. They must write what they hear without review.
I was not concerned about the judgment of how important the stuff is that I'm working on. So certainly there will be different issues about that, but at least that the results are reported accurately or discussed accurately. I mean, this I think I need to see the final piece.
Well, I think we need definitely another session on that one.
Condescending to ask the reporter before they leave, and presumably you'll do this face to face over the phone, can you explain what I told you back to me?
Yeah.
Say just you know, what is your if you had to give an elevator talk of what I just told you, which is presumably what they're going to do, what is the bullet point that you just took away and make and they're not gonna public most of the stuff we really care about, the big press releases, the Higgs boson, the way that's condensed is enormous information compression. And often by analogy, many of which we will find many things to nitpick with. And that sometimes has to be done. You know, how do you explain the Higgs boson in one sentence? But what the reporter takes away from whatever conversation they have with us is probably the one thing that we can at least ask them to do, and I think they would. Would you feel does that come across as condescending if we ask? So now that we've had this conversation, what do you think were the key things that I just told you, and what do you think you're going to highlight in your story?
Yeah, right.
Is that too much to ask? Is that
No. I think that's fair, and I mean, a journalist should agree on that. I mean, you could make that clear from the beginning, saying I only talk to you if you tell me what you want to make out of it, or give me another call once you're done with that, that I get an impression. But if you put too much pressure on it, say if I'm not allowed to read your thing, then that might be the end of it. I mean, to be honest, yeah.
I think that's called good communication. I mean, in any conversation, if you're not, if it's a one-way street and you're just doing a brain dump on somebody, whether it's a reporter or your spouse, you're not going to get back, you know, what you think in the end, right?
Yeah, because I think assuming that the journalist is a good journalist, then you have to assume that you're talking to a different audience than the one of your colleagues, as also Martin was saying. And I think you should try to communicate as much as possible well with the person and make you, you know, well understand, like politicians do, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that that's a good point. You have to think about the audience first, right?
Who is that? But I respect the journalist's independence. They have to report it. Sometimes it will be bad, but that happens in all fields, all reporting.
But
I know the problem, the only problem is you might say it is associated with me, but, you know, it is authored by the journalist. It's not authored by you.
So maybe my comments came across too strongly. I did not mean to distrust the journalist. I mean, I understand they are professionals too, and they do their best they can. But the notion that I will not see at all before it goes public what is written disturbs me.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, that it's handled differently. But if you
deal with the editor, the reporter could write a great piece. The editor takes it down to fraction of what it wrote.
Yeah.
You can't have a say on that.
I would like to have the opportunity to say, I think what you wrote there is a little bit iffy. Could you please modify it? I don't want to prescribe how it's modified, but just to give an opinion.
Okay, I think I would love to come to the last slide now. That would be, how could you use all this information? I see you are already in it, so this is wonderful. So I choose that picture for a takeoff. So the little prince wants to go to another place, and you might just go into the world of the media, or it might happen to you, for example, because a reporter calls you, or somebody asks you for an interview, so you might not even have planned it, or you might have planned it because you need some PR for some reason, you need funding, or whatever. And so how could you make your own PR, your own business? How could you get into the world of the media? So there are different ways to do that. I mean, that's just the other way around. We discussed it until now. That's like you could make a press release and or ask your PR officer if you've got one to help you. You could put something on YouTube, or you could make a podcast. You could call a journalist you know and use your personal contacts. No matter what vessel you use for that voyage in the world of the media, it can be a lot of fun. And I hope that we keep this conversation going and have a lot of fun until I'll be here, probably longer than you guys, until Thanksgiving. And my room number is 1202, it's up in the end of that hallway on the other side, and I'll be happy to discuss with all of you about your personal questions or about science journalism in general.
Thank you.
I think we'll just break straight to the topic.